So hiking holds its own rewards, its own dangers. You have to pack for blisters and for changes in weather and food in case you get hungry. You don't usually pack for capture. In the summer of 2009, Shane Bauer and Sarah Shord were living together in Syria, teaching and writing. Their friend, Josh Vital, came for a visit from the U.S. They hiked up into the mountains of Iraqi Kurdistan to see the sights. They hiked along a road that turned out to be the border between Iraq and Iran. An armed man waved them over. That's when they discovered they'd crossed into Iran. They were arrested. Sarah, Shane, and Josh tell their story in a book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Their story is every prisoner's tale of the fear, the deprivation, and the loneliness.
The three Americans became part of the international tensions between the U.S. and Iran, the battle over sanctions, nuclear negotiations, internal squabbling among Iranian factions, kept the accused spies in prison for 2 years. When they took you prisoner, would you describe the mood that the guards or the people who took you prisoner conveyed? What was their attitude, Shane?
It was mixed. I mean, we were there at this kind of post. They brought us to this kind of shack on the other side of the ridge in the mountains. We were there for at least a couple hours, and at first there was kind of, you know, a lot of interest. There was maybe 10 people there, and then it got kind of strangely slow and kind of almost had a kind of a boredom, sense of boredom. But there was one, a commander who was, you know, who was kind of the most interested in us. And he was kind of joking with us in a way that was, you know, frightening. You know, we would ask what was, you know, going to happen to us. And I remember him kind of smiling and running his finger across his throat. And it was like, it was obvious that he was messing with us, but it was, you know, not really a time for humor. And then he also, you know, I asked if we could, if I could make a phone call to call a fourth friend who was with us on the trip, who didn't go on the hike. And he surprisingly let me do it. You know, he took me to a spot. He had another soldier take me to a spot where I could make a phone call. He said, if you run, he's going to shoot you, but go ahead. And then, you know, they tried to put us in this vehicle, and we relented, you know, or we resisted and said, you know, we want to go back to Iraq. And they're really shy about kind of putting us in there for a while, and eventually they just kind of drug us in.
That's Shane Bauer. When they took you prisoner, could you see how they might think you were spies, Sarah?
You know, Shane and Josh and I all have different kind of opinions on this. Whatever questions are about getting into the minds of our interrogators or our captors, it's all theoretical. But my experience with my interrogators was that they were really trying to find a way to frame me as a spy and having a very difficult time at it, but that they never truly had those suspicions. And even the border guards, the first thing they did when they picked us up was take me to buy a headscarf, a hijab, because a woman, it's against the law for a woman to be in Iran without one. In northern Iraqi Kurdistan, women dress however they please. But we would have been arrested just because of the way I was dressed from the get-go. So I think it was blatantly clear that we had no intention to come into Iran, that we were unprepared for anything even like that.
You guys wrote that you imagined this might last a few weeks, the situation you were in. Why'd you think that?
Well,
Josh.
Yeah, it just seemed like they were asking questions, you know, and they were looking into me, and I thought, well, okay, they'll naturally be suspicious of these people in their border area, but once they, you know, however long it takes them, if they interrogate me a couple times a week for a couple weeks, then they must be done. You know, then they'll see everything there is to see. They'll go through all my emails. And once they know the truth, they'll let me go. That was sort of at the beginning when I was, when I thought that truth was important.
When truth was important. Didn't one of you write that they had told you, your interrogators told you that they knew you weren't spies?
Oh, yeah. We all had that happen at different times.
Yeah.
For me, it was after 2 months of interrogation. My interrogator came and said, you know, Sarah, I've been telling you that you're going to go to court, and I thought that was true, but now your case has become completely political, and even though I know you're not a spy, I have no idea what's going to happen to you if you'll go to court. If you do, it probably won't be good.
Hmm. Did you guys get mad early on? Were you just, were you mad at them? Did you know you were there? That you were mad at them?
Yeah.
Did they know you?
I mean, I was angry for much of those 2 years, from the beginning.
At them? At your captors?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were during interrogation. It was, there was a couple of days of kind of asking, what we're doing in Iraq and things like that. And then it was clear that it was just kind of searching for details of my life that could make me look like a spy. And they put us in solitary confinement. They didn't let us see each other. They didn't let us see a lawyer. They didn't let us call home. We didn't know what was going on. There was plenty to be angry about.
Do you remember this section that I'm going to ask you to read? Remember what was happening here? Set this up for us. What was going on right then?
So we had been in Iran for a couple of days at that point. We were... we drove off the mountain, and then we were kind of passed off from one group to the next. We were interrogated by different people, pretty poorly. It was obvious that the people interrogating us didn't have much skill or experience in doing these kind of things. And we were driven to one city. I don't know what city it was, and we were brought into an apartment building, and we were interrogated there, the three of us separately. And then at nighttime, we were put in a car and driven out of the city. It was dark, and so this is where we are. "Where are we going?" Sarah asks in a disarming, honey-sweet voice. "Sss," the pudgy man hisses, turning around to face us and putting his finger to his lips. The headlights of the car trailing us light up his face, revealing his cold, bored eyes. He turns back to face the front. The solitary lights of country houses stream by like little meteorites. The car falls silent again. He picks up the gun in his right hand and cocks it three times. Sarah's eyes widen. Her posture stiffens. She leans toward the man in front and, with a note of desperation, says, "Ahmadinejad, good. Obama, bad." The pistol is resting in his lap. He turns to face us again and holds his two hands out with palms facing each other. "Iran," he says, nodding his head toward one hand. "America," he says, lifting the other. "Problem," he says, stretching out the distance between them. He checks our faces to make sure his message registered, then drops his arms.
That's Shane Bauer reading from his book, A Sliver of Light, along with Sarah Short and Josh Fatal. I know you guys have been asked this many times, many, many times, and I know you've answered it many, many times, but I have to ask you, what were you thinking going up into, just hiking at all up in that area? I mean, what really... There must have been some thought. So what were you thinking? What were you thinking? You came and visited these guys. So what were you thinking they were thinking?
What was I thinking they were thinking?
No concern when Shane and Sarah said, "Look, let's take a hike up near the Iranian border and check out these waterfalls."
Yeah. Well, if they would have said that, I would have gone the other way. They never said such a thing because they didn't know and we didn't know that we were going to go up near the Iranian border. What we were thinking was that, Iraqi Kurdistan is a safe place and a lot of tourists are there. And then when we were in the city for a couple of days, different cities, we said, "Let's get out of the city. Let's go on a hike." So we asked people where to go on a hike, and they point us to this waterfall. And there were a lot of other families at that waterfall. And then our sort of zealous selves, we decided to go beyond the waterfall and hike up several hours. And I think it was at that point that we were stepping into unknown territory. And of course we realized we were in a place that we had no expectation to be in.
Yeah. So a lot of families, you just wanted to maybe get a little more privacy just to see it in a different light. Is that part of it?
Yeah. And it was a beautiful place. And Shane and I have been living in Syria for over a year, and there aren't a lot of opportunities to go in, green, beautiful mountains. We wanted to get to the top of the ridge so we could get a view of the area. And we were going by word of mouth. A lot of people had pointed out the trail to us. Many people had pointed out Ahmed Awa. And we also knew that we were in a pro-American region. Iraqi Kurdistan is almost its own country within Iraq. It has its own borders, its own history, its own language. And no American has been killed or captured there in decades. So Shane and I both traveled in more dangerous parts of the Middle East, and we took utmost precautions, but our guards were really down because we were in a safe region.
did a guard actually, did some guy on the other side of the border actually say, hey, I like this, like friendly gesture, come on over?
Well, it wasn't friendly. I mean, he looked surprised to see us. It wasn't, I wouldn't say it was particularly aggressive either. I mean, he was surprised, you know, we were surprised, and it's like we're up in these mountains and we're in Iraq, you know, where we have military and, you know, all this stuff. And so he says, okay, come here. What are you guys doing?
Shane Bauer and Josh Vital shared a cell for much of their 2 years in prisons. The little things became important. You described this point where they're, I think it was you, Josh, they're, you have to move to Shane's cell. Is that what happened?
The other way around.
The other way. You had to move. So you had to pack up all your stuff. You weren't so, you were, hey, this is my home. I don't really want to be moving at this point. You're sort of starting to feel the rhythm of prison, huh?
Right. Yeah, yeah. There were many stages where that happened. And there were times before that that I had been moved, and it's like, you know, as much as I hated being in these places, I would kind of settle into a space, you know, and it's you know, once you move, everything feels so unstable. I don't know what's happening, you know, where, what the next step is. We'd already been moved from one kind of ward to the next ward. And we just kept, it felt like we'd gone through all these stages of just getting deeper and deeper into this situation. So when they came and told me to pack up my stuff, I thought, one, maybe I'm getting free, or two, you know, I don't know, whatever, it's not, if it's not that, can't be good. And they walked me down the hall and opened the door to a cell, and Josh was sitting there, you know, inside. And I was just blown over, you know, I was so excited.
Did you like
4 months in solitary?
Yeah.
4 months in solitary, yeah. Did you like sharing the cell? Was it too close quarters? Were you glad to be together?
Well, at first it was like, you know, there was so much, you know, it was 4 months of my mind going crazy to be able to talk about it and to be able to get it out of my head and have a good friend to talk about it with. And so that was like kind of these amazing few weeks. And then we found different rhythms and ways to cope. But at a certain point, you know, we were in a cell that has a few arm lengths in each direction, and we are with each other 24 hours a day full time. And even though we were great friends before, there becomes a point where you just want to be able to take a walk.
You know, this prison is always described as Evan, notorious Evan prison.
Mm-hmm.
We describe it. What made it notorious? What was the like in that prison? What did it smell like? What did it look like?
Hmm. Well, it's where political dissidents are imprisoned, tortured, beaten, held in solitary confinement for long periods of time, and sometimes, or maybe more than sometimes, executed, brutally hung. And it was a political prison. Well, it's the whole compound. It has a general population and a political ward, Section 209, where we were held. And people were held there during the Shah regime, and then after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And when we were there, it was full of political dissidents from the Green Movement that had erupted a few months earlier in the capitals of Iran, people that were protesting the re-election of President Ahmadinejad, saying that the vote was stolen.
Yeah.
And so the political section, the women's ward where I was full of protesters, human rights lawyers, student activists, very strong, intelligent women.
You were in solitary confinement, what, 14 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you hear? What could you hear out of your cell?
It changed a lot. There were months and months at a time where everything was silent in my corridor. All I would hear is a whimper every now and then from another prisoner. And then there were times where it really erupted. The Ashura protests that happened in December 2009, just a few months after we were brought there, I thought that the Green Movement was over. And then all of a sudden, the prison filled with new political prisoners fresh off the streets of Tehran. That day we heard helicopters circling and knew something was going on. The guards were agitated. And the cells in my corridor were packed, 8 to 9 women in a cell. Some of them went by my cell bloody, and that was a very raucous, exciting period. It was terrible because I knew that a lot of the women around me were being beaten and tortured, but they also, their resistance inspired me.
Really? To what end? Just internally? Or did you act out in some way?
Inspired me to definitely break the rules. At first, I was scared to communicate with other prisoners, and then some of the women there started to pass me notes, and we came up with a clandestine method of passing notes. They would sing to me down the hallway. If they could, they'd push past a guard and throw their arms around me. And they didn't. One of the messages that I got was never let the guard see you cry, and it was sort of at a time where we were all shifting from more of like pleading and begging and trying to reason with the guards to just making our demands.
Hmm. You guys spent some time fighting with guards.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was one time when you had a blindfold on and pushed it up, and blows were being tossed. And
yeah,
what would even prompt you to engage in that kind of battle with guards?
So yeah, Josh, we're on the way back from our moment in the courtyard, and it's kind of a continuation of what Sarah said. We were kind of in this process between other Iranian prisoners inspiring us, each other, like me watching Sarah, watching Shane, watching me, and we all kind of realized that we could push the boundaries of how we could behave with the guards. And at one point, walking back from the courtyard, I just remember there was this one guard who I kind of had an issue with, and I really wanted to press him on it. He didn't bring me the box of tissues that I thought he was going to bring me a few days ago. And so when I saw him, I confronted him about it, and he just blew up. And he's pushed me down the hallway and into the offices. And then he ran right back upstairs and then dealt with Shane.
Yeah, and I was kind of trying to chase after Josh because I didn't know what was happening. They just took him downstairs. I don't know where he's going, what they're going to do to him. And some guards were holding on to me, and then this guy came back upstairs, and he just put me in a headlock, drug me down the hallway, grabbed a billy club from his desk, threw me in my cell, and raised a billy club up over my head, and I just said, whoa, you know, back off, you know, it's over. And he left, and as soon as he left, I immediately went back to worrying about what was happening with Josh, and I just decided to just pound on my door and cause a commotion. And he came back and put his fists up, and I told him to hit me, and he was, you know, he kind of lurched forward towards me, and I just kept yelling at him, hit me, where's Josh? And he, you know, I knew that we were valuable at that time, that the Iranian government wanted to exchange us for prisoners in the U.S., and and that, you know, if this guy hurt me, he would get in trouble. And that was, you know, this guy was huge. There's no way I could fight this guy.
What'd you call that guy?
We called him AK, which was short for ass kicker. We heard him beating other prisoners other times. And he, you know, threw me against the wall, and I fell on the floor, and another guard came in and stopped him kind of right in the nick of time.
So you felt a little bit like you were in a privileged position because
yeah.
of your status.
Yeah.
But all around you, you saw people being beaten and disappeared. You must have been either a little crazy or a little afraid, or a little bit of both.
Yeah, I think it was both. I mean, we'd been in prison for a while, and, you know, it's like the stakes felt so high in there, you know, and it would just kind of reach a breaking point at that time. And then Josh came back, and, you know, he was okay. He wasn't hurt. And the administration after that, the prison administration, really kind of freaked out about it for a little bit. You know, they were really worried, and they ended up giving us more time outside with Sarah after that. So it really felt like kind of a victory in some ways, you know.
And that was our demand for months. We had been wanting, all of us, to say we need more time outside. So after that fight, that was...
Right, right.
And you talk about, you know, it must have been a little crazy. I mean, I think the bigger fear was actually losing our minds or being dehumanized, being permanently damaged psychologically. Months in solitary confinement, I was reduced to a sort of animal-like state. I would pace my cell for hours, crouch by the slot in my door, just listening for sounds. I had to fuel my desire to live through anger, through resistance, through doing anything that I could not to let myself become institutionalized, become a part of that place. So standing up to the guards, standing up to our interrogators, it was a matter of just human dignity.
And something really influenced us was one of the first time we got books from home, we got The Slave Narratives of Frederick Douglass. And one thing that we all got from that book was, you know, just reading about his time as a slave and how terrible it was, kind of, and he made it through, you know, kind of gave us hope that, okay, we can get through this if he got through that. But also there's this story where he talks about going to this man whose job it was to break slaves, and he was trying to break Douglas, and he beat him all the time. And one day Frederick Douglass fought back, and he said, you know, you can't just beat me like this. And they had this kind of long fight, and it wasn't clear who won, But after that, this man never beat him again. And every other place he went, every plantation he went, he was never, ever beaten again. And we really took that lesson and kind of decided that, okay, we need to change the way that we interact with the guards, because if we kind of hold ourselves a different way, if we stop letting them push us around, then they're, you know, then maybe they will. And that's what happened, you know. I mean, there were times like this guy blew up and there was another fight right after that, but that was it, you know, and it really kind of shifted the way that they interacted with us.
We're talking with Sarah Shord, Josh Vital, and Shane Bauer about their book, A Sliver of Light. What's this scene? Will you set this scene for us?
Sure. Sarah? This is about 6 months into our imprisonment. And at this point, I'd completely given up on the hope that they'd ever let us call our parents. And this is actually important because as much as we were protected in some ways by the fact that we were high-value prisoners, that, you know, we were like money in the bank that they were eventually going to cash in and that the whole world was going to see how we were treated. So they didn't want us to be physically, you know, have physical scars, but psychologically we were fair game. And most other Iranian prisoners, as I know it, get to call their family regularly, maybe once a month. So this has been 6 months, and we come in, and it's the first time I'd seen my interrogator in several months, and I was enraged with him. And after yelling at him for a while, it came out that the reason he was there is we were going to finally get phone calls, and we all just went into shock. So this is, I've dialed the phone, and I'm hearing the phone ring across distance. It just feels like I'm calling another planet. And then her answering machine picks up. "Mom, it's me." The words run rapidly from my lips. "They're giving me a chance to call, and I'm calling you from prison. I'm okay, and I'm coping. I'm still in solitary confinement, and that's really hard. I see Shane and Josh for an hour once a day, and they're together. I have books, food, some letters. Everything you're doing means so much to me. We know that we don't have the details, but we know a lot. It gets through to us, Mom. I never knew my strength until now. I'm as strong as I have to be. You're an incredible person, and I know you're doing everything you can. You don't have to have the power to make this decision, Mom. No one does. No one knows how we're going to get out of here. We're learning a lot. We're trying to make the best of this time. You're going to be amazed by how good my math and vocabulary are. Tell everyone I love them, our family, and all." The phone cuts off. "Ugh," I yell. "You have to let me call her again. I know she'll pick up this time. Please." "Okay, Sarah, but you've already used 2 of your 5 minutes. Go ahead." I pick up the receiver, dial her number again, and listen to it ring and ring. The phone picks up, and I hear my mom's voice, urgent and trembling. "Sarah?" I begin to cry.
You said that you had, those were words you had. You knew that you had had these words. This was the dialogue that you had spoken.
Yeah, my mom. Well, the advantage of having left an answering message is she had it recorded and she could share it with all of my family and friends. And so I listened to it when I got home and I wrote it down. So that's verbatim exactly what I said to her.
You all discussed the idea of writing a book at some point when you were in prison. Is that correct? Why did you have that conversation? Do you remember it?
I mean, I think we just felt like we were learning so much. And changing so much. I mean, I felt like I had, you know, especially in solitary confinement, but afterwards, and that I had never experienced suffering in that way. And then when I got out of solitary confinement, I would see the layers peel off. I could see that I was becoming slightly more of a full human being. And as I learned a little bit more about myself, as I learned about myself in this context of such extreme conditions, it was just something to share. And you know, we're in 3 people in a place that has hundreds of people, and so it's a story that you know, people need to hear, because it's a story that can shed light on what's happening to a lot more people.
You asked you before, is it cathartic to have written the book, but also to talk about it around the country? Is there some catharsis involved for you, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like as much as it, at times I hated having to go over everything, again and again. I mean, the impulse when you've gone through something traumatic is just not to look back, to move on with your life. And that's, and it's half of that, you know, is a healthy impulse. I mean, Shane and I don't want our whole relationship to be defined by our imprisonment. We want to talk about other things, do other things. But having a way, a structured way to go over everything forces you to make sense of it, and really, more importantly, to make something meaningful out of it. Because when we were in prison, we were just surviving. It was just a day-to-day thing. And to write a book, you have to really understand, what do I have from this experience to offer the world?
Hmm. What remains of your feeling of prison? Do you have prison in your head still sometimes, Shane?
That's a hard thing to answer. I mean, there was a long period where I would have definitely said yes, and I was trying so hard to get it out, and I couldn't. And I don't feel that way now, but I do still feel very connected to prison in a lot of ways, and that's kind of guided my life after getting out of prison. I've kind of ended up visiting prisons in the United States, and my work, my journalism has kind of started to focus on that. Prisons in this country, where, you know, we have more prisoners than any country in the world. But there was a time, you know, a long period of time where I felt like, I remember telling Sarah that I felt like I had a demon inside of me, and it was like, I was free physically, but my mind just felt so institutionalized, you know. I had a hard time, you know, we'd go out to eat with people and I'd have to leave suddenly. I just had all this anxiety. I would have nightmares about going back to prison, nightmares about my interrogator, just yelling at him at the top of my lungs, you know. And that, you know, that just took time to kind of taper down.
You know, you end this book by saying, actually, who's written it? Is this epilogue from each of you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all your voices as one?
No.
Is that you at
parts.
The end?
Yeah, I'm at the very end.
You at the very end. I'm grateful that in the midst of all this, I was able to say the one thing that made the most sense to say, that everyone deserves justice, everyone.
Yeah.
So I guess for all of you, I mean, you come out of this and you were high value, so you weren't the same as the people who end up in prison or killed on the side of the road. It's informed your journalism.
Yeah.
Well, how do you take this going forward? Sarah.
I think in a way I identify more as an ex-prisoner now than I did as a prisoner while I was in. I'd never wanted to become a prisoner, to accept that place as home. But coming out, I felt so alienated at first. One of the hardest things about the post-traumatic stress was having no one around me that had gone through solitary confinement, not being able to make sense of what had happened to my brain in there. And so I sought out other ex-prisoners, other survivors, and made sense of my story. And that has become my work. I work with Solitary Watch, and I've been gathering written and oral histories of people in prolonged solitary confinement in this country for a book and for a play. So I think there's a misconception that all people in this country in solitary confinement are the worst of the worst, are violent criminals. In fact, it's gotten completely out of control. There's 80,000 people in any given day, and many of them are in for petty infractions, and many of them are mentally ill, so they're not easy to control in the general population, and they end up in solitary confinement where they get worse and worse, and are often released directly into the streets, where coming out of solitary confinement was a really difficult experience for me. I had rages, uncontrollable rages, terrible insomnia, depression, and I had a really supportive community. Most people don't have that, and they end up back in prison. They end up, you know, homeless on the street.
There was a report that came out, I forget who did it just recently, said that equated it with torture, solitary confinement equated with torture. How do you go forward, Josh?
Well, it's been a long journey, and luckily now it's been more time free since being out than being in prison. It's been almost going on 3 years now, and you know, I was stuck. We were stuck as pawns in this political game between U.S. and Iran. And I had the feeling in there, and it's only strengthened since getting out, that being in that situation, I felt like I was paying for these decades of sort of hostile foreign policy in the Middle East and towards Iran in particular, and Iran retaliating by taking me. And it felt particularly unjust to me when I was in there, because I felt like, you know, I opposed U.S. wars against Iraq and, you know, et cetera. So that I feel that, like, when I've come out, and luckily the Omanis, who ultimately were the ones that brought me out of jail and were the negotiators that eventually, you know, secured my release, and they opened up the avenue for further nuclear talks between the U.S. and Iran. So the idea that it's moving towards peace is a good thing, and that these countries are slowly starting to find some way to end these decades of hostility is something that's, like, dear to me in a way that it never was before. I felt like I really came to terms in prison with how central relationships were to my life, and just, like, what's really important to me. You know, just thinking about my mother, my father, my brother, my family, my friends that I was in prison with, and other friends, and you know, I've moved on in life. I write occasionally, you know, sort of supporting the diplomatic process, and I advocate for this, but. I'm also started a family, and I just feel like this has given me a new view on kind of what's at stake in these political games between governments.
Yeah, real people are involved, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.